And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, that kind of interesting time after sunset, before sunrise, when it's dark and the stars are visible and we realize the universe is a lot bigger, a lot more complex, a lot more intriguing, a lot more mysterious than it appears during daytime. So, continuing with that theme, our guest this morning is Georgia Lambert. We're going to talk about reality, kind of a different way to look at reality. In fact, many different ways. But before I get to Georgia, I'd like to express real thanks to Robin, who stepped in last week when I was not feeling very well. Look, guys, all over the world, please, you got to stop panicking when I don't feel well. You know, that's what happens sometimes, you know, particularly when you have a sinus thing. Wind blows and whatever. So, you know, Robin was able and did a brilliant job from all the emails I've been getting. You know, it's so funny because I'm ill, Robin takes the show, then I spend so much time reading all these accolades. If you want to send accolades to Robin, please send it to Dr. Robin Falkoff at healthfreedomrights.com. Because every email I get, I either have to read to her or I have to copy and send to her. And given how many people were expressing appreciation of her efforts, because she did two brilliant interviews with two guests that I wanted to talk to, and she did a really great job, and I'm so appreciative. But look, folks, please don't panic. There's no reason to panic. You know, and in future, I'm going to warn you, depending upon how things go, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes with this show and with a lot of other things, bigger things, as you're going to hear in the next few days. I may have to leave this chair, this studio, for a few days, a day or two, maybe 3 or 4 days, and go and do some stuff kind of undercover. Yeah, I guess it would qualify as undercover. And I know that all sounds very mysterious, but there's a lot of very, very interesting stuff going on. So, A, stay tuned. B, don't panic. And C, send your appreciation directly to Robin, because she certainly deserves it. Okay. Robin and I last night together sat, you know, with Mirella, and we watched the Oscars. How many out there, raise your hands, how many out there watched the Oscars last night? I know, anywhere in the world, how many watched the Oscars? The reason is the Oscars were incredibly important last night. Important why? Because you know my thesis, and part of the discussion we're going to have with Georgia this morning is Hollywood. And what is Hollywood really, really, really doing in our space, in our culture, in our lives, in our existence? What's the real purpose of Hollywood? That'll be part of our discussion, as you will see. But when I looked at the Oscars, you know, Robin and I both caught so many bizarre things. I don't want to take the time tonight from Georgia, but tomorrow night, it's Open Hailing Frequencies. We're working on trying to find Mark Ebner, remember, a Hollywood reporter? And if we get him, I'm going to, you know, talk to him in the first half hour. We're going to talk about the Oscars and the intense symbolism and the signaling from someone to someone about what is coming. Just think about the Oscars. If you didn't see him, go and look at the tape. Go find it on, you know, YouTube somewhere. Go look, because there were so many clues as to what some folks are planning for the future in last night's Oscars. Actually, it was 2 nights ago, because this is Tuesday morning. Okay, Georgia Lambert, let me switch gears here. Georgia Lambert is becoming a very dear friend, because every time, you know, she comes on the show, wonderful and interesting and amazing things happen. Like, it was a total surprise to me the last time I think she was on the air that she had been at 17... a gorgeous ingenue, one of the passengers on the SS United States. I'm gonna reflect back on that conversation in a moment, because there's been some new news and I want to talk to her about it. So Georgia Lambert has spent over 50 years in the field of esoteric studies, has received formal training in Eastern and Western disciplines, methods, and traditions. She was the first to be licensed by the state of California to teach meditation and esoteric physiology, an experimental course she presented for 3 years at the College of Osteopathic Medicine in the Pacific. In the past, Georgia has received has served on the board of directors of United Health Resource, has been on the staff of the Institute for the Health Facilitation for 3 years, taught 2 years at the Institute for Advancement of Human Potential, and served on the teaching staff of the Philosophical Research Society for 10 years under Manly Palmer Hall. And we're going to be talking at great length tonight about the Philosophical Research Society and Manly Hall and things in general and the universe and the strange tremors in the force that are going on. Georgia, welcome to the other side of midnight once more.
Good evening, Richard. It's great to be here with you again. Well, glad you're feeling better.
I'm feeling so much better. And you know what really helps you feel better is when you know you can count on someone to take on the responsibilities that you temporarily can't. And that's what Robin did, and I am immensely grateful because not only did she do yeoman service, but, you know, like remember that old commercial with Mikey and the breakfast cereal? They yes. liked it. I mean, if I get one more email extolling the virtues of Robin, who I've only known for, what, almost, a generation, my paramour in life. Anyway, please send her all your notes directly because she would love to read them. And I've got to do a couple other things and not just refer notes. So anyway, back to you. The question, Georgia, is what's going on right now? I mean, are you following the news? Are you watching the meltdown of society? The United States of America is kind of collapsing into this bizarre, multifaceted, you know, arcade fun mirror house, one of those rides you used to go through when we were kids and went to carnivals. Something bizarre, something fundamental, something esoteric, I think, from a scientific perspective, is going on. And so what better person to ask than, Georgia, what's going on?
Well, if I knew the exact answer to that, I would have put money on American Pharoah several years ago. But it is a circus out there right now. And as you always say, this is one of those times where the surf is up in the force, isn't it?
It sure is. Gosh. I mean, it's giving me whiplash. You know, it used to be that, you know, election cycles, which is kind of how our culture in the large scale measures time, occurred in a very orderly way. You know, it had yearly cycles. It had, you know, decadal cycles. In other words, it had kind of a structure you could analyze and predict. And of course, science is nothing if it's not prediction. So political science is called that because you use all this data from all these voters and then you make predictions and then you tailor campaigns and things are supposed to kind of follow A, B, C, whatever. Nothing like that is going on this year on either political side of the spectrum. And to me, it's when I talk about politics and I talk about elections and campaigns on the show, some people freak out. And what I'm trying to do is to call people's attention to the fact that the election this year, the big campaign leading to November, where we decide who the president's going to be for the next 4 years, is not so much an election, but a chart of the consciousness of the culture. It's where we are. It's who we are. And we're being presented with choices, Georgia, which are almost like good versus evil. It's astonishing.
Well, you always say that we're in a time when the good are going to look better and the dark is going to look darker, and we're certainly seeing that playing out in this circus that we have.
Isn't it? It used to be you had to really kind of focus and pay attention and look for things between the lines. No more.
I know.
You just sit and watch, and they just tell you their truth, and it's up to us to decide what truth is our truth and which we want to go with because all the games seem to be falling away, and the cards are really being put down on the table face up.
Absolutely. And I think in one of our earlier conversations, we talked about the fact that, you know, for the population that is awake and alert and spiritually oriented, future decisions have already been made, but the average individual is not really trained to subtlety.
No, wait. Back up. Tell me what you mean by that. How does being alert decide something in the future versus not being alert?
Well, by alert, I mean consciously awake and focusing on a positive future rather than one of fear, which so many people want to promote these days.
Yeah, there's something on your mic somewhere. Don't bang the table when you make points, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Being awake or being conscious means, looking for and reeling in a future that is positive and globally responsible. So, unfortunately, the average individual isn't that subtle. And so things have to be really blatant, really black and white.
So, in other words, people are not going to pay attention until things are really out there, kind of like the language. And the language has taken such a radical, depressing turn. I mean, I cannot imagine not imagining that presidential candidates would actually stand up on television and accuse each other of wetting their pants. I mean,
this is amazing.
It's more than amazing. It's telling me we have some consciousness break with things as they have been, and everything is in free fall, to use a space term. It's kind of like one of those shots in a space station when the spin goes off and everybody's suddenly floating free. And everybody's looking for an anchor and looking for leaders and looking for, you know, where they should be and where they should go and who they should follow. And none of the normal rules seem anymore in a whole broad area to apply. And is that part of an esoteric approach to figuring out what's really going on?
Well, you can't really make change if you're stuck in old forms. So the old forms have to go.
Okay.
And if we don't give them up voluntarily, they have to be broken down. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing.
So you mean we can't make change peacefully or quietly? It has to be a hard landing because we're what?
Well, we can make change peacefully, but we never choose to. You know, there's something about humanity that doesn't want to change until our backs are against the wall and things are absolutely at the bottom of the barrel, and we're forced to make those changes. But the choice to make changes in a positive way is always there. It's just one that we don't usually take as a group.
There's some weird bumping going on your end, because nobody's bumping the mic at this end. So let's see if we can figure out what that is, because it's very distracting.
I'm sorry. I'm not getting anything like that on my end.
Huh. Okay. We'll track it down. Maybe it is at this end, but I don't think so, because, no, everything seems... Anyway, moving back.
You're talking about, surfs up in the force and weird synchronicities. I got to tell you about something that happened that made me think of you this week.
Okay.
I was doing some spring cleaning and trying to narrow the event horizon of the black hole I call my library. And I came across this book that screamed your name at me. It's a book that was written by a Daniel Dermile, who was a late professor of psychology at the Columbia University. And it's an English translation of an earlier book from France, written originally by a professor Flournoy, who was the professor of psychology at the University of Geneva. Now, he died in 1921, so the original French book was written in the early 1900s. And it was a case study about this woman who, at the time, was quite a famous medium. And she also remembered her earlier incarnations, not under hypnosis, but just remembered them. And she was being studied by psychology. And she had some interesting ones, one of which was in India, and some of what she conveyed was later proven true. But she also remembered incarnations on Mars.
You're kidding.
No. And no, it gets better. She was also an artist. She painted pictures of buildings, of plant life. And they're in the book, the paintings that she did in the late 1800s. And I'm thinking, wouldn't it be a hoot if some of the geometry that's being discovered correlates to some of her paintings. Wouldn't that just be...
That would be incredible.
So if you or M would like to send me a mailing address, I'll pop this book in the mail to you, because it should really be in your library.
Okay. Well, obviously, any mail to the show goes to, let's see, you can send it to Enterprise Mission, P.O. Box 1041, Placitas, P-L-A-C-I-T-A-S, New Mexico, 87043.
I will get that to you sometime this week.
Oh, my, my, my. Now, you say this was written in the 20s, and it was
yes.
it was an analysis of a person who remembered other lives in the 1800s, and this woman, an artist, remembered living on Mars. Is there any more? I mean, what was the basic conclusion of the doctor?
Well, remember that in the late 1800s, people pretty much believed that there was life on other planets.
I think particularly
on Mars.
Sorry, George, I've figured out what's wrong. You're popping your mic. You need to move your mic relative to your mouth.
Oh, okay. Is that better?
We will find out.
I moved away from it a little bit.
That's much better, yes.
Okay. She was quite famous in the late 1800s, and she was studied by psychologists because she was such a phenomena of the day. And, it's all in this book, her incarnations that she remembers in India, but the Mars ones have the pictures. And some of the buildings look like Lego pieces. And most of her drawings of the more elaborate buildings look very Mayan or Aztecian and Tibetan.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so, you know, it might be complete hooey and fancy, but I just thought it was really interesting, and you should probably have these pictures.
Oh, I would love to see them, because we now have ground truth to compare them to. We have spacecraft on Mars, obviously, the Opportunity rover on the one side of Mars, and the Curiosity rover on the complete other side of Mars. And the Curiosity rover is giving us astonishing evidence of shattered artifacts, ruins, structures, junk, debris that's been obviously heavily eroded by, you know, forces from the time that it was new and pristine and shiny and highly geometric and all that. It would be intriguing to see if anything in her art matches the ground truth we're seeing.
That's what I was thinking. And she also has a couple of pictures of plant life as well.
Oh, my. Huh. Okay. Well, that's going to be very useful. And you know, the reason this is important in context is because next week, I believe on Thursday morning, we're going to get the gang back. You know, the imaging guys, Keith and Andrew and Warren and all those folks. Say again?
Oh, I just lost you for a minute.
Okay. And we're going to talk about artifacts elsewhere in the solar system, not just, you know, this time on Pluto, but we've got other stunning examples, and including some really amazing stuff that's going to be high-resolution close-ups taken from some of the Apollo imagery on the moon. And if I said Thursday, I meant Thursday next, not this Thursday, the 10th of March. So that's when we're going to do this. And so if the book arrives in time, which U.S. mails being what they are, it probably will, we might be able to scan some of those images and pop them up if there's anything to compare. So, yes, that's a very interesting idea.
Great.
All right, let's you know what I found you're doing? You're popping your peas. You obviously
I'll move back a little bit.
You are a teacher, and you project, and I do the same thing. But yes, that's what's happening. You're popping your peas, or we need to get you another mic for the next time we do this, because that mic does not like your peas.
Okay, I'll move back a little bit.
Let's not get echo. Let's try it now. All right, I wanted to talk tonight primarily about Manly Hall, because that was the first big book that I got decades ago to look into esoterica. Somehow it fell off a shelf, or someone gave it. I forget the exact story. But Manly Hall has always fascinated me. So let's start with who the heck was Manly Palmer Hall, and why should we even care that he set up an institution in Los Angeles to look at things that go bump in the night?
Well, let's back up just a minute and take a look at what was happening in Los Angeles. You know, the last time we had one of these waves of the surfs up was in the late 1800s. That was the time when you had in science, in the arts, people starting to think about things like time travel, and esoterica from the East was coming into the West with theosophy and other things. And there was just a lot going on. And Los Angeles, being the heart center or heart chakra of the United States, began to attract everything.
Well, can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Why is L.A. the heart center? What do you mean by the heart center? Who defined the heart center? You know, in other words, I ask questions about rules. I hate rules. So who defined L.A. as the heart? To me, L.A. is not heart at all. If I had to pick a place in the United States that represented the heart,
right,
I'd pick some antebellum place, probably Charleston, South Carolina maybe, but not. No, L.A. wouldn't fit in my book. So why is it the heart center?
Well, you know that every life form has this energy body that underlies it.
Okay.
And the organs of the energy body are called chakras or
right.
centers. And it's long been given out in many esoteric forums that the United States, in terms of its center system, and just because a center is a center doesn't mean it's fully awake yet or functioning. We've got the head center or the crown center in D.C., mm-hmm. Which is pretty latent. And
you mean looking for intelligent life on Earth? Do not look in Washington?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
And the throat center is in New York, which is also an international center because of the United Nations. The heart center, the original one, was in Philadelphia. And the heart center is not just called the heart center because it has heart center energy. It has to do with where a lot of life is anchored and then circulated to the rest of the world or to the rest of the life activity. And so the heart center is sort of the anchoring of the life thread. A lot of stuff starts in California and then spreads elsewhere, Hollywood being a good part of that.
Mm, major part.
Yeah. Remember that in the 70s, the whole holistic health movement really sort of took off in California and spread from there. So in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, everybody came here. You had the Paramahansa Yogananda with the Self-Realization Fellowship came to Los Angeles. You had the Vedanta Society. You had Steiner's Anthroposophy. You had Theosophy. You had Alice Bailey's Arcane School. Everybody that was anybody came here. The one difference with Manly Palmer Hall's Philosophical Research Society was that in all of these different groups that came here, of all different qualities, the Philosophical Research Society was the one place you could go where you could access all of them. It was a center for synthesis, and it was the only one like that.
Okay. So was it, Manly Hall created this center, but back to the question, who the heck was Manly Hall?
Well, Manly Hall was a very, very interesting individual. He was born in Canada, and from what I can gather, his mother was a Rosicrucian chiropractor, and they found their way eventually to Santa Monica. And he founded something called the Church of the People and became a very, very charismatic speaker.
I think we have a picture of him. If we go to othersideofmidnight.com and click on Radio with Pictures, upper right-hand corner, takes us to your page tonight. And you've given us a set of very interesting pictures. I think number one is Manly Hall when he was a very young guy.
Yes. Okay. And you can see very, very charismatic looking. and
it kind of looks like, oh, who was that incredible silent film movie star that women threw themselves, you know, in front of? Oh, who was that guy? He looks like him.
Kind of. He does have that sort of 1920s,
yeah, and
Houdini
Valentino. That's the guy I'm thinking of. He looks like Valentino.
Very much so. Very much so.
Back in those days, it would have been called mesmerizing, yes, effect on people because of mesmer and hypnotism and all that. But look at his gaze. Just look at him. He somehow can reach out of the screen and grab you.
And if people Google him, there are even other photos that have an even more intense gaze. It's really quite astounding.
Fascinating.
So anyway, he founded this Church of the People, became very charismatic, drew a lot of crowds, and that evolved into the Philosophical Research Society. And with the patronage of the people that came to hear him, he got to travel all over the world and collected esoterica from all over the world that finally found its way into the book that fell into your hands, which is his masterwork, A Secret Teaching of the Ages. But he wrote many, many other books on esoteric subjects. But that was really his masterwork.
Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour, and I don't want to abridge any of the details because the details are very important here. And we have other images to go through. We have your whole relationship to the Philosophical Research Society. We even have, we'll kind of save that. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning is Georgia Lambert. We're talking about consciousness and waves of consciousness that change over time and the catalyst for that. And we seem to be in the middle of one of those right now. And a very interesting catalyst indeed, which we'll talk about in a few. This is Bobby Bright, his Loving Rock and Roll, and we'll be back.
Love to hear that bass on line laid down by a friend of mine. Music makes a bond that's not for breaking. Yes, I'm a child of rock and roll, just a boy who can't say no. I'm a child of good old rock and roll. Loving good to me through the years. Been high times, there's been tears. Seen a lot as I travel around. Through it all, there's been the sound of good old rock and roll.
We are back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Georgia Lambert. Okay, when did you meet Manly Hall, and how did you get involved in the Philosophical Research Society in the beginning?
Well, I had been not only having my own classes, but doing a lot of work for the Freemasons and talking to them about the esoterics behind some of their degrees and things like that. And Manly Hall was a Mason, and he heard about me from, I think, one of my students, and invited me to speak on a Sunday morning. Every Sunday morning, they would have a presentation, an hour and a half presentation. Manly Palmer Hall would usually do it, but occasionally they had guest speakers. And so I was first invited to be one of the guest speakers. And became so popular that I became a regular on Sunday mornings. And eventually, I was asked if I wanted to teach there. And I did an interview with Manly to make sure that what I was teaching was in keeping with what they wanted to promote in their society. It was really amazing. I was invited into his sanctum sanctorum, his office, and it was sort of like little Harry Potter going into Dumbledore's office.
Well, by that time, he'd been established in L.A. for what, 30, 40 years?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And you know that, you know, in all those years, the stuff that he had seen, it's really interesting that and a side note here, that all of his alchemical stuff and magical stuff was in his early years before the war. Something happened during the war. I don't know what, but the tone of his work changed after that and became much more mystical and philosophical rather than sort of magical and occult. And so
so it went from kind of a Crowley approach to a much more, well, philosophical is a good word.
Well, even in his early days, I don't think he would have seen Crowley as much of a friend.
No, that's not what I meant. I mean, years ago when I had one of these ship cruises, I invited an anthropologist friend of mine on to talk about the Indians in South America who basically developed certain, you know, very interesting technologies that had to do with language and geometry and symbolism. And we talked about, you know, technologies that are neutral. Well, Crowley used the same thing, magic and other
right.
Modalities. I wasn't alluding to the fact that Manly Hall had the same philosophy about magic, just it's the same technology. And again, like we're talking about a few minutes ago, it's the light side of the force versus the dark side of the force.
Exactly. And, you know, we know that there was a lot of really dark stuff in play during World War II. Maybe that's a conversation we should have at another time because there's a lot involved in that. But
if you bring up Nazis and esoteric, it will take us till dawn to get through
right.
that. So no. But we will tease that for another time, yes.
But there was a lot of really dark stuff that was going on. Well, the light side was active too. In England, we had amazing people like Dion Fortune and Wellesley Tudorpole who combated a lot of that dark stuff. And these are, especially Wellesley Tudorpole is somebody that your audience should probably know about. He was a friend of Churchill's and was responsible for the silent minute at 9 o'clock when Big Ben struck every evening, where the whole intent of the country was focused. He also, in his younger years as an army officer, saved the life of the family of the founder of the Baha'i faith. So people like him and Dion Fortune were working on the light side of things. And I would imagine
let me back up a second. You mean during World War II, when England was, you know, obviously not sleeping, every night at 9 p.m. or was it morning, a.m.?
It was 9 p.m.
9 p.m.
When Big Ben struck, the whole country focused together.
By edict of Churchill listening to
Wellesley Tudorpole.
Ah, so they basically were doing consciousness experiments to win the war.
Yep.
As almost, 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago.
Yep. And Dion Fortune, another very famous esotericist of the day, was having her groups in London, in the Blitz, meditating, and she moved to Glastonbury along with Wellesley Tudorpole, and they were just on other side of the street from each other, working on the subjective side of things for that war effort. So, you know, if that kind of stuff was going on in England, you got to figure that Manly Palmer Hall knew about it and probably was involved in something similar on this side. Although there's no records that I can find of that, it would be astounding if he was not.
Well, it just seems to me that you've opened up an interesting can of worms here, because you're saying that this war, the World War II, that's in our history and has, you know, basically created the rest of the century and now the beginnings of the 21st century, that basically archetypal esoteric forces on both sides were at war at a higher level at the same time that, you know, guns and bombs and tanks and airplanes and B-29s and all that.
Absolutely.
Fascinating.
And that would be a wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's go back to Radio with Pictures. We got a very young Manly Hall.
Yes.
Number two looks like what's that famous painting of the? Oh, my memory tonight is totally failing me. You know the story. The painting that retains all the age while the guy stays young.
Oh, Dorian Gray.
Dorian Gray. Thank you. It looks like this is a version of a Dorian Gray painting because. That's the same Manly Hall in picture number two? Number one?
Yes, that was one of the last portraits that he had done. And in the last 10 years of his life, he was quite frail.
Okay.
But still doing his
Yeah, we're having some Skype problems, so you may have to repeat that last part.
Yes, he was still doing his work Sunday mornings.
You mean
his
regular broadcasts? Did he do radio broadcasts at any point?
I'm not. There was a lot going on in the 20s and 30s that I certainly wasn't a part of, so I can't really speak to that. But it's certainly possible.
Okay. Okay, so back to Manly Hall. His life and his institution there in L.A. I'm sorry, we're having Skype problems, so you're missing what I'm saying, and I'm missing what you're saying, which is really a problem. I'll tell you what, why don't we quickly go to some music, and let me try to recontact Georgia, because I don't think this is going to work. I think we lost her completely. Tell you what, before we go to music, let me just see if I can get her back. And, you know, it's that old cliche about, you know, the little girl with a curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was horrid. And that's what Skype can be like. Let me try to figure out here where I am. Come on. Oh, there we are. Okay. And we'll see if we can get her back. Okay. Sorry, folks. This is what happens when you try to. Are you back?
I am back.
You're back. Wow. Okay. So where were we?
We were talking about Manly Palmer Hall and when I knew him, and I was telling you about the interview that I had in order to teach there, going into his office. And
in order to appreciate this properly, I think we have to go back to Other Side of Midnight, and we have to click on picture number six, or maybe five.
I'm not sure which of those two.
Well, if you sent them a sequence, number five probably is a good one. Because that, is that you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. and this is basically how you look when you went into... interview with him.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, five and six are me. Number five, I'm on the stage under a portrait of him, lecturing on a Sunday morning. And number six, I'm in the library.
Oh, my gosh. If you click on them, it makes a much bigger version. And wow. Back in those days, I think they would have said you were a looker. Oh, my gosh, what cute, amazing images. You look like something in number six, like out of a movie.
Oh, well, that's very kind, I think.
I love the hat.
Well, you know, when you realize...
I'm sorry, I just want to get people to have a feeling of you in L.A. talking to Manly Palmer Hall all those years ago, and this is the you that was doing it.
Right.
Okay, continue, please.
So we had this very long conversation. I thought the interview would be, 15 minutes or so. But we had a very long talk, And he wanted to make sure that what I would be teaching was not something that would develop psychic ability, that it was consciousness-oriented and spiritually-oriented and not the development of psychic activity. And so that was a lot of our conversation. And after that interview, I became part of the teaching staff and was the only one on staff that was actually allowed to teach techniques, which I did for 10 years there.
Okay. Techniques. Please explain techniques.
Meditation techniques, techniques for inner growth and development. Masons would say truing the rough ashlar into the perfect block to fit into the temple.
Okay. Don't pop your peas.
Okay. trying really hard.
Okay. So, all right. So they hired you and... were you one of the only women involved at that time?
No. There were other women.
Oh, good.
And certainly Mrs. Hall, who was fascinating in her own right.
I didn't know there was a Mrs. Hall. I don't think anybody knows there was a Mrs. Hall.
Oh, I've got to tell you about this.
Absolutely.
Mrs. Hall actually was raised in a convent, and Manley was her second marriage in 1950 or thereabouts. Manley and Mrs. Hall had their own little empires. Manley had the Philosophical Research Society, and Mrs. Hall, Marie Bauer Hall, had something called the Veritas Foundation. And as Manley was doing his work, she had her work, and she was a Baconian scholar and was very into Francis Bacon and that whole thing, the esoteric foundings of this country. And she wrote two books that you should know about, Quest for Brute and Vault and Foundations Unearthed, where she actually led an archaeological expedition in 1938 to find a hidden vault with Baconian repositories in Williamsburg.
Now, when you say Baconian, you're talking about Francis Bacon and the whole controversy. Who wrote Shakespeare? Did Shakespeare write Shakespeare, or did Francis Bacon under a pseudonym write Shakespeare? That kind of thing.
That kind of thing. And also Francis Bacon's involvement with the Virginia Company and the founding of this continent and all kinds of Rosicrucian and Masonic ideals being worked out here in the early part of our nation's founding.
You mean the whole New Atlantis thing?
Exactly. And the Quest for Brute and Vault is sort of an interesting mystery that is even better than the whole Oak Island mystery.
Oh, really?
Oh, much, much better. And she got involved with the Rockefellers and trying to use, and this is in 1938, ground-penetrating radar, and the book, you know, her books talk about all of the clues that she and Manley found in ancient writings from England to find this vault where all of these esoteric papers and charts and documents were supposed to be stored. It has yet to be found, but she got really, really close. And that's an absolutely fascinating story.
Oh, my gosh.
I was privileged to be at her home for dinner a few times after Manley's passing. And at that time, her whole focus was on the divine feminine. But she still stands alone as an amazing Baconian scholar. And that whole Brute and Vault project, you can Google it, Brute and Vault, that's Bruton Vault. It's an amazing esoteric story involving the early foundings of this nation and a whole bunch of stuff about the founding fathers.
Who would be the best person to have on to actually talk about that sometime?
I actually have a friend that is an expert on her and that particular project. So I will get in touch with your producer and maybe we can get her on.
Perfect. Perfect.
It's really interesting that there were all kinds of tunnels under Williamsburg. This Brute and Vault, where this cache of charts and documents were supposed to be kept, put there by the Masons primarily, probably. It was under the altar of the original church, but there were tunnels that ran all around. And one of the tunnels went to a house that was just to the back of the church that was owned by somebody called George Wythe. And all of the founding fathers were in that building at one time or another. It even served as Washington's headquarters at one particular point.
You mean Washington slept there too?
Yes. Okay. Oh, and just as a weird side note, the original family name for George Washington was Heartburn.
Really?
Yes. This is just really amazing. Back in the 1100s, the progenitor of George Washington, his name was actually Heartburn. And when he bought new land and moved to the new land, he took the land's name of Wessington and established the Old Hall, which is the family seat of George Washington. Now, the cool thing about this is he married the sister of the King of Scotland, William the Lion. This is in the 1180s. So Washington actually had royal blood. And many people know that in the right after the Revolutionary War, the crown of America was actually offered to George Washington. And people thought that that was strange. But that crown was originally offered to a very aging Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was in exile in France. When he declined it, it was offered to Washington. And rightly so, because he was actually of that royal blood. And of course, he declined it.
Well, this seems to be part of part and parcel of the idea that if you kind of go back to the family trees of all the U.S. presidents, you find they're all related.
Do you know that there's only been one American president to ever go to England and visit the Washington Old Hall, which was given to the National Trust? And you know who that president was?
No.
Jimmy Carter.
Really?
Yep. In 1977, he made a visit there.
Do we know why?
Nope.
Has anybody ever asked him?
I don't know.
I think it's high time. Obviously. Okay, so we're kind of wandering far afield. This is all part of her research, Maria Hall,
yes.
Manly Hall's wife, totally obviously focused and obsessed with, was Francis Bacon really Shakespeare, et cetera, et cetera. That's an incredibly interesting story. I'd love to talk to your friend. But she basically carried out her own research in parallel with Hall himself?
Yes. They each sort of had their own empires. And it was parallel but different. Manly Palmer Hall was so controlling, in a good way, over the Philosophical Research Society that I think he sort of steered her in another direction just so she wouldn't get involved with his
so
stuff.
So he wouldn't have competition.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. So he threw her a bone and she ran with it?
I think that was a good part of it, yeah.
Interesting.
There's another story that when the Philosophical Research Society was actually being built, and it was built by a very famous architect named Robert Stacy Judd, who was an English architect that had traveled to Chichen Itza and became fascinated with Mayan architecture. And he combined Art Deco and Mayan architecture, and the building of the Philosophical Research Society is that Mayan Deco kind of thing. And when they were putting in the patio, the story goes that Manly was in his office, and as the workers were laying in the tile on the patio, Manly ran out with a bit of tile that he wanted incorporated in the patio. And this little piece of tile is a chunk from the uncovered tile floor of Glastonbury Abbey from England.
Ah.
And just as another weird thing, talking about Hollywood, when you think of George Lucas and Star Wars, do you remember the Wookiee and that critter, the Tauntaun, which was that sort of snow kangaroo that they rode?
Yes.
Wookiee and Tauntaun are two towns on either side of Glastonbury.
Oh, isn't that special?
I thought you'd like that.
That's wonderful. Okay, what is image number three on Other Side of Midnight Radio with Pictures?
That's Manly in his later years in his office.
Oh.
And you can sort of see that he's got artifacts everywhere from all over the world. And it was this sort of higgledy-piggledy jumble of just stuff everywhere.
Do you see what's sitting on the table in front of him on that other book?
Oh, the triangle?
The equilateral triangle, representative of a two-dimensional version of a tetrahedron in three dimensions.
Surrounded by Buddhas.
Yep.
And African artifacts and everything under the sun. That place was a repository not only of Manly's incredible mind, but artwork that was amazing. They had priceless Tibetan tankas, the vault that they had original Albrecht Dürer prints just tossed in to the vault. He had works from the Middle Ages. This was a library that scholars could come to. The library was open to the public.
Okay, so we need to click on number four, because there's the library, right?
Yeah, that's a good part of it. And there were works going back to very, very ancient times and work from just all over the world. And people could come to the library freely and study and do research. And it was just this amazing place for synthesis where all the world's esoterica could be studied and worked on together rather than just one particular lineage or that particular lineage. People could compare and see how things fit together. It was amazing.
It looks amazing. So, okay, so Manly Hall, you know, instituted this center, the Philosophical Research Center, again, in what year?
It was very, very early. It was in the 20s.
Okay. And his vision was it would become what? A global center for research in esoterica involving all cultures, all times, all ages, etc.?
Right. It was sort of a physical outpicturing of that great book of his.
Okay. Now, did he bring very famous esoteric scholars and speakers and investigators to L.A. to be part of like a college or part of a community like the Advanced Center for Physics at Princeton?
Not all at the same time. There were these sorts of people filtered in and out of there doing presentations, and this was sort of a format where they could reach, you know, the L.A. audience. But Manly was sort of a benevolent dictator. He really kept a tight rein on everything. His board of directors was very much people that had been with him since he started and would just approve anything that he wanted to do.
Interesting. So what did he want to do? What were some of the things he did with the center?
Well, again, he invited people from all over the world to give presentations and speak there and that sort of thing. And not just esotericists, but artists as well. Many pianists and artists also had a sort of venue there to present. And he did this for, you know, decades and decades and decades.
So no wonder you felt intimidated in that meeting.
It was like I said, it was very, very interesting. But after that original interview, I got to visit them in their home from time to time. It was really, really interesting. The first time I went to their house.
I'll tell you what, why don't you save that
okay.
for the other side of the break, because we are at the top of the hour. Once again, my guest this morning is Georgia Lambert. We're talking about the Philosophical Research Center there in Los Angeles, Manly Palmer Hall, its founder, and how Georgia Lambert got to meet him and work with him and what happened after that. Here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Back on the other side of midnight. It is about 43 degrees here in the land of enchantment tonight. We've been having incredible summery weather. It was up to the lower 70s today. Stunning clear blue skies. The mountains are like so close you can touch them, and they're miles away. Well, that's what it's like living in the land of enchantment. Anyway, Georgia, you were about to tell us about an interesting dinner at the Halls.
Well, the first time that I went there for dinner and I walked into their living room, I was completely taken aback because they had this beautiful painting of Marie Bauerhall as a young woman hanging up over the fireplace. And this painting was almost a dead ringer for a painting that I grew up with of my mother. She looked exactly like my mother. It was just really bizarre.
Oh, my God. That must have been stunning.
It was. It very much was. And, you know, even after Manly's death, Marie had wonderful dinners and brought different artists. I remember one time an opera singer came and entertained us at one of her dinners. And, you know, she, after Manly's death, became very, very focused on her own work and very driven. So there wasn't much conversation at those dinners, only her going on about what she was into. But she was an amazing person. And Manly, you know, you couldn't really ever get to know Manly. He was very remote. Again, an amazing mind. But very remote in the years that I worked there.
What was it like working for him? Because I mean, you're working for a legend, and yet you see him every day, day by day. He's married. He's got a family life. You know, all the usual things that I guess people, you know, have to put up with. Unless he'd arranged a system where he didn't have to deal with all of that, did he?
He really didn't. He sort of had his world organized where. He kept to himself. And of course, in the last few years, he became very, very ill and very, very frail and started to trust people that he should not have trusted, which eventually led to his murder.
Hmm. Now, when you say his murder, this is a very controversial area. Why don't we talk a bit about it?
Well, you know, we can learn a lot of lessons from what happened to Mr. Hall. It's very, very interesting that people like Mr. Hall that are pioneers in what they do and they push hard all of their lives, very often in their declining years, they either rely on people that perhaps they shouldn't, or they revert to some system that is well-built and gives them comfort, like some organized religion. Examples would be one of the grandmothers of osteopathy wound up as a physician to Catherine Coleman. I've known esotericists that have been esoteric pioneers all their lives and then in their later years become Mormons. It's not uncommon that these people that have pushed so hard want something safe and secure to rely on. And Manly, who had wielded, you know, his benevolent dictatorship on his board of directors, started trusting a couple of people that came into the organization to be an aide to Manly. Now, Manly was very, very huge and needed help standing and moving in his latter years and getting to and fro and really needed help. And an individual came on the scene that volunteered and was completely unscrupulous and began to worm his way into the situation and alienated Mr. Hall from all of his old friends, the people that on his board and that had worked with him since the beginning. They knew what was going on. They tried to talk to Manly about it. He wouldn't hear of it. This person started separating Manly from his wife. All kinds of really nasty stuff.
Georgia, let me ask you a very fundamental question. if we're dealing with various degrees of enlightenment, if part of our mission here as human beings is to learn discernment and enlightenment and all that, and Manly Hall was the quintessential sage who had spent a lifetime mastering, reading and studying and working in these traditions, how could he be taken over by an unscrupulous underling in that fashion? Where was his discernment? Where was his enlightenment?
Well, this is the interesting question, isn't it? It's because he was failing. He needed help. And when the people that he should have trusted, his old friends and people on his board, tried to talk to him, all he would say about it was, well, a leopard can change their spots.
Oh.
And
so he was on a rescue mission and it ultimately got him killed.
Probably, yeah.
What's the actual background? What's the story that led to his demise? Why is it so controversial? I mean, murders happen every day. Why is this one we kind of walk very delicately around it?
Well, for a while it was because of liability issues, but the original people have since died, so that shouldn't be a problem. I gave your producer a website. I don't think you put it up. It's a website that has a complete written transcript from Mrs. Hall herself on what went down and all of the details.
Okay. If we can get that posted, Rich, that'd be nice to have at the top of Radio with Pictures. Make it the first link. Well, you'd have to renumber everything, so just put it in after number 6. This is the link to Maria Hall's description of how her husband was murdered?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did she die? And when?
She lived to the ripe old age of 100.
Oh, my gosh.
And she died in 2005.
Just oh, my gosh, that's like only, what, 10 years ago? Well,
yeah.
11 now.
Yeah.
Huh. Fascinating.
So she kept going till the bitter end.
So, all right, give us some of the soap opera. Why would someone kill Manly Palmer Hall? Normally people kill people because there's something to gain. What was there to gain from murdering Hall?
Well, the easy answer is money.
Okay.
These people insinuated themselves not only in terms of taking care, supposed care, of Manly's physical needs, but they wormed their way into the PRS trust. And they started pilfering things. Manly had a stamp collection that was worth over $1 million that showed up on the black market in Germany.
Oh, my God.
All of the books, particularly on alchemy and magic, started to disappear. Some have never been found. After Manly's death, the Getty Center bought a lot of those books, but many of them just disappeared and were never seen again.
Golly.
All of the art that they had, the Tibetan tankas, the artifacts, all have disappeared.
Well, you mean all the stuff we see in these pictures is gone?
Most of it, yeah. PRS today is run by some very sweet, ethical people that it's run as a university. They still have programs and things like that, but it's not the same. The last time I was there, all of the art from the walls had gone, all of the tapestries and the paintings and the sculpture. There was a wonderful bust of Blavatsky that Manly had sculpted himself. Lots of it disappeared, and much of the library is gone.
Oh, my God. Now, you say it was money, but was it – see, the thing I'm always thinking about when I deal with these situations is if you have someone like Manly Hall and his stature, and he collected and assembled all of this information in one place at a time when information had to be in one place, unlike the Internet now – is it not possible that he was targeted to basically destroy the center and to eliminate him and to remove his light influence in this sphere?
Well, on a deeper level, I would say yes to that. In fact, on the surface, it seems like a money operation, and they tried to, you know, get the property. And by the way, that property at the heart of Los Feliz in Los Angeles is a gold mine. And right after Manly's death, they tried to sell it. And I was still having my classes there, at least for a short time, until I was rudely let go by the bad guys.
Oh?
Oh, yeah. And
so you were there during the soap opera?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I was there for all of it.
Oh, go back to the beginning. Go back. You got to tell us how it happened. When we're talking about a murder mystery here, we got a few minutes. Track us through what happened.
Well, it's very, very complex. And again, I would, if you want the details on what the actual finish was, look at what Marie wrote.
Okay.
But for a couple of years...
I'm looking to see if Rich has posted it yet.
For a couple of years, these people insinuated themselves into the whole structure there, and Manly became so dependent on them. He was supposedly a, quote, healer, and started doing all kinds of things that really contributed to Manly's debilitation. Every day high colonics, and they had this machine that would take his blood out and do something with it and put it back in him, and I mean all kinds of just really weird stuff. At one time they tried to convince Mrs. Hall how romantic it would be if she and Manly had a suicide pact together, and she told him to go pound sand, basically.
Wait. This guy, this healer, the guy that Hall was defending as deserving a second chance, was talking to her background and saying, wouldn't it be nice if you guys killed yourselves together?
Yeah.
And when she told Manly that, he said, you're nuts. He never said that, right?
He just wouldn't listen. He wouldn't listen to anybody. Everybody tried to talk to him, but he just would not listen.
See, this is an era before what we now currently, well, not exactly before, but you wouldn't think of it in the American context, brainwashing?
Yes, exactly.
Did you have any evidence?
Manly became so physically dependent on these people, he also became psychologically dependent on them.
So you think it was just a natural segue from being physically dependent to basically looking at people that are taking care of you. You look at them favorably, otherwise they won't take care of you. I'm asking something more direct, which is, did they literally do something to his mind to turn him in a way that would destroy his life's work?
I think so, because Mrs. Hall wrote that toward the end, he seemed very afraid.
Oh.
Now, the weird thing about it is, and like I said, I was there during the whole bit and aftermath, I got to, I was the one that the staff trusted, and so they would come to me with info, little bits here and there. One by one, each of them was intimidated or blackmailed by these bad guys. And so they couldn't really do anything.
So this was really a hostile takeover.
Yeah, it was.
In the worst sense of the word.
In the worst sense of the word.
And Manly Hall had built in no defenses for his work, the work.
No, and this is another good lesson. It is vitally important that people that do the kind of thing that Manly does train their successor as they go. Manly was such a control freak that he would never do that. There were many times where he would bring someone up and just on the verge of, you know, really being in a place where they could take over for him, he would let them go. And so there was no one to stand with him end.
In other words, he was afraid of being knocked off and his trainees getting as good or as better than he was, so he kept removing potential competition?
I don't think that was it. I just think that he was just so in control of everything that he wasn't going to relinquish any kind of control in any area. Mm. But what that did was, like I said, it put him in a position where there was no one strong enough to stand with him at the end. And there was some other really weird things that happened. After his death, it just so happened that two of my students had a run-in with these bad guys at a much earlier time. I guess this guy had some sort of shady birthing clinic in Hawaii.
Does this guy have a name, by the way?
Daniel Fritz.
Daniel Fritz. Okay, by the way, Rich and Keith have posted the link. So if you go to number 7, there's a direct link there to Maria Hall's testimony on Manly Hall's death?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's very interesting.
I will click on it and see what happens.
It's long.
It's so. Loading. It's long, yes. It's 1.8 megabytes. It's 4.4 megs. About the premature death of my husband, Manly Palmer Hall, a personal opinion written by Marie Bauer Hall.
Yeah, that's
there it.
There it
is. Okay.
So anyway,
thank you guys, by the way. Thank you.
It turned out that two of my students had a run-in with this guy when he was running some sort of shady birthing clinic thing in Hawaii, where he would just do weird stuff like have the women meditating for hours to try to conceive his child through the ethers. I mean, really strange, off-the-wall stuff. Also, there was talk at that time. Now, this was before he ever came to PRS. There was talk that, Manly would discarnate, and he was trying to prepare a new vehicle to incarnate Manly's spirit back into. I mean, really strange things. One time I remember I was in the gift shop waiting to do my class, and there was this little Hindu lady in there whom I had seen in the Sunday lectures and things like that. And she came up to me, and she asked if she could ask me a question, and I said, certainly. And she said, I've heard that Manly's going to die soon, and he's going to inhabit your body with you. Is that true? And I was completely taken aback, and I said, nope, there's nobody in here but me, and it's going to stay that way. But there were hints of this before it actually went down. And as it was happening, like I said, the older people that had stood with him all these years were scared off. They were intimidated. They would come to me with little bits of information. I talked to the detectives afterward and found out some really interesting things that never made it public.
Like?
Well, in Marie's explanation, she thinks that Manly was actually killed in Northern California on a trip, and his body was brought back. He was found in his bed, in his pajamas, on a particular morning. However,
he was found in his bed on a particular morning. A particular morning, is the morning important, the kind of morning it was?
No, it was just the morning of his death.
Oh, okay.
But at that particular point, the rugs were being cleaned as the paramedics came. And the detectives told me that, and Marie makes reference to this, that actually ants were found in his body, which belies dying in bed, right?
Particularly if the medical examiner arrives in a couple of, an hour or two.
There was no medical examiner. It was done over the phone.
What?
Yep.
You mean just like Justice Scalia?
Yes.
With the same ritual pajamas? I mean, you understand I'm going.
I know. And it's all in Mrs. Hall's testimony there.
But this is amazing. This is fantastic because, as you were describing this, I suddenly flashed on Judge Scalia and the weirdness around his death and the pajamas and the delay and the medical people never arrived and it was done over the phone.
Yeah.
You mean 50 years earlier, the same thing was done, or not 50, but whatever it was, was done with Manly Hall?
Yeah, pretty much. And the thing that one of the detectives did tell me is that the ants found in his body were not Southern California ants.
Oh, my.
From Northern California.
God, we're talking CSI. Remember how the lead actor in CSI playing Grissom is the guy, who was the forensic pathologist. He had this real passion for entomology.
Yeah.
And all the shows that somehow, almost everyone had some entomological aspect where you were dating this or timing that by insects, ants or cockroaches or whatever. You mean the detective actually said to you, we think he was killed somewhere else because the ants don't live down here.
Right.
Wow.
It's really interesting that toward the end, right before his death, when I was getting a lot of the info from the people around him who had been run off or intimidated, I was still holding my classes there. I was doing the Sunday presentations, but I also had my classes there. And my classes were good size. I had 50 to 80 people in my classes. And
were these weekly or daily?
Weekly.
Weekly, okay.
And doing meditation work and things like that on the premises. And I'm sure I was seen as a threat because there was talk.
You mean a threat by the bad guys?
Yeah, because some of the older people there had said that the bad guys had radionics machines and they were using it nefariously. And a couple of times during my classes, they came in and took photographs of me on the stage teaching. And to see
what you look like, we should look at what, number 6 again?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this was supposedly for use on their radionics machines. But they couldn't get rid of me, and I stayed there till the end.
No, wait. If they were going to put your picture, let's say it was number 6, although it's not number 6, but let's say you took your picture and they put it into a radionics setup, they could then basically, direct bad stuff at you?
Yeah.
Did they try?
I'm sure they did.
Did you feel it? Because there's been a lot of that stuff going around this show. I mean, really weird stuff. You wonder why I don't feel well sometimes? It's because somebody's directing something. And the reason I know that is that many years ago, a very well-connected friend of mine told me, before they tried to kill me in Florida, in my hotel room with a device beamed through the wall, whatever happens, if you feel, and he described what I would feel like, he says, move, get out of the damn beam, otherwise you'll die. I remembered that morning. I did that. What was the medical exam when they eventually did an autopsy? Did they ever do an autopsy? If I'm sorry,
that's no autopsy.
So we don't know the cause of death. The detective who talked to you and said there were ants in him, he didn't really know the cause of death, though.
Right, because the bad guys shipped his body off to be cremated immediately. However, Mrs. Hall intervened and stopped the procedure, but couldn't stop the embalming.
And of course, the embalming process completely destroys all the evidence.
Yeah. Hmm. And the detectives did tell me that there were needles found in his body. I mean, I heard things from...
Wait a minute, needles? You mean like sewing needles?
No, broken hypodermic needles.
In his body?
Yes, because this guy was doing this treatment of injecting urine into Manly. I mean, all kinds of really horrible, horrible things. And it's just really sad that someone of this stature made this sort of end, you know. It's just really heartbreaking. But, you know, we don't know the karma involved. And this is the way it certainly went down. And, of course, after his death, the minute that they got control of the organization, I was given 2 days to leave and move a class of 80 people somewhere else.
So they obviously looked at you as the enemy.
Well, they certainly didn't want me around.
Now, you said the staff would come to you and tell you various things. Were they concerned that the staff was telling you stuff that would have ultimately unseat them, dethrone them, lead to a palace coup?
I can only speculate.
Well, you know, feel free.
You know, I'm sure that was probably the case. I was very popular at the time. I was the only one that did the Sunday morning presentations regularly, and they liked me because I could get up on the stage and talk for 2 hours without any notes, like Manly did. So they felt very comfortable with me.
Interesting.
And so as they wanted to take over the organization, I was certainly not somebody they wanted around. Plus the fact that this building, which I mentioned before, was actually made by a famous architect. They wanted to sell it because the land there at Los Feliz was worth a mint.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And they tried to sell it, but one of my students quickly organized a small group called the Friends of Manly Palmer Hall, and they pushed through the paperwork to have PRS declared as a historical monument where they couldn't sell it.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, so we sort of spearheaded that, and they weren't too happy with that.
Well, that also means they must not have been very well politically connected if that actually worked and they couldn't sell the property and the building and all that.
Yeah, right.
Fascinating.
I think so.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We've got 1.5 hour left with my guest this morning, Georgia Lambert. When we come back, if you want to call in and ask a question, our numbers are wide open. It's on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or Other Side of Midnight. And the number is 505-796-8802. And if you don't call, I'll just continue because I have a lot more questions. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Do you whip yourself down the street? Hoping to find yourself in the glass.
And we are back here on the other side of midnight in the pre-dawn hours, that magic time. Anyway, Georgia, big picture now. What was the central focus of the Research Society Why was it destroyed, and what could it have done if it had continued in its original form through now to the present?
Gosh, well, as I said before, its great contribution was that it was a center of synthesis. He did what you like to do with this show, which is connect all the dots.
Hmm.
And there was no place else like that here in Los Angeles, where, again, all of these different esoteric traditions could be studied together.
And you were there from when to when?
I was there the last 10 years. He died in 90, so I came there around 1980 and was there for the last decade.
Okay. So looking at the whole institution, what was the high point? When was he the most influential, and how did his influence manifest?
Well, probably in his much earlier years, he was the most influential. And as I said, with
the Manly Hall is known by everybody into esoterica. You can't get into any of this stuff without, you know, tripping over Manly Hall.
Right, because he synthesized and compiled all of these different systems. Plus, he did something very interesting. When all of the esoteric stuff from the East started coming to the West in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then in the 20s and 30s, everybody was into Eastern stuff, you know?
Yep.
And,
yep.
And you see a lot of this even today in the whole New Age or metaphysical movement, a lot of Eastern forms. Hall really delved into the Western esoteric traditions, which were harder to find because they had to go underground during the Inquisition. And so they were very covered over by symbology. He really unearthed a lot of the very rich esoteric tradition of the West. And this was an amazing contribution. In terms of
When you say the esoteric tradition of the West, you don't mean Eastern, you mean actually Western.
Western esotericism.
Like, give us an example.
Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism,
okay.
Kabbalah.
Excellent, okay.
Those sorts of things. Alchemy. These are all primarily Western traditions. Some of them may have had their roots in the Middle East, like alchemy, but
didn't alchemy go back to Egypt?
Egypt, yes. Egypt was called the land of Chem.
Kemet, yes.
And alchemy was the art of Egypt, the art of Chem.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it really took off in the West and exercised a lot of thought that later emerged in the Baconian groups and the Rosicrucian groups and that sort of thing. So Manly really brought the rich wisdom of the West into the light of day. As far as the organization and what it could have done, you know, after Manly's death, I had a few difficult years because I thought, I felt like I had failed somehow. I felt like there was something more I could have done or should have done. And, you know, looking back, logically, there really wasn't. But I felt bad about it. However,
you mean kind of like what, survivor's guilt?
Kind of, yeah.
Hmm.
And
but you were just one of how many people working for the Institute or working for the Society?
Well, I was only one of a very small handful, a few regulars
at that time,
if that many. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but you know, later in meditation, it came that the paradigm needed to shift, that the old model of esoteric organizations like Theosophy or, some of these older traditions like PRS that were made on that kind of model where you had one really charismatic leader, that needed to shift to a group focus. And the organization was being shifted from a physical organization to an organization in the field or the force.
Mm.
It's kind of like what you're beginning to do here with all of your guests and connecting the dots. You're building a community that's not all physically together, but is a community whereby what one guest has to give dovetails into a lock and key relationship with what another guest has to give. And so it's creating this whole sort of community that shares tools. This was not the case in the earlier age. You know, when you have infants, there's a stage that babies go through where you can put babies in a room together and they'll play side by side, but they won't interact. Then there is the actual movement to interactive play. One of the things that we see in a lot of these older esoteric organizations is parallel play, but not interactive play. That now is the time to begin to share tools and not to be so protective of their own techniques, their own vocabulary, their own language. You see this with the old esoteric organizations. They don't play well with others, and that needs to change. And so I think that it was time for PRS to fade into the sunset. It didn't have to do it in such a horrible way, I don't think. But it's time, and it's time for a lot of these types of organizations because something new is building and something new is taking its place.
It's like in the natural world, we have ecological systems that are born, they grow, and they die. And as they grow, sometimes they evolve, and then they die, and then their progenitors or their successors, they take on the new. In other words, change is part of life. Are you saying that Manly Hall built up this institution, it had achieved its purpose, and it actually needed to gracefully exit the stage?
Yes. Hmm. And this is true with a lot of the traditional esoteric methods. And we're seeing that some of the organizations that can rise to the occasion and become part of a bigger round table will continue, but others will just be allowed to sort of quietly implode as the inspired leaders just aren't there anymore. You know, in Masonic terms, in talking about what PRS is today, and Masons will understand what I'm saying, that the hand of philosophy is there, the hand of morality is there, but the lion has left the building.
Oh. Why are there so few? In fact, I'm trying to think. I don't see any lions like there used to be in these areas. Is that just my perception, or is something fundamentally changed?
Something's fundamentally changed.
Like we don't need them anymore?
It's not that we don't need them, but the format is different. You know, from the time of the Greeks, and a lot of Western esotericism goes back to the ancient mystery schools of the Greeks, you had the technique of what is called isolated lights, where you had a great inspired leader. They would come into incarnation, collect a bunch of people, found a school and a philosophy, and off they go. But today, those individual leaders are being replaced by a group format so that you don't have the kind of individual, charismatic, single leaders that you did in the past. It's more of a round table focus of synthesis. And this is what the Philosophical Research Society sort of pioneered, this frequency of synthesis. But it couldn't move into the next stage. Manly wouldn't let it go.
In other words, Manly was a flawed messenger?
He wasn't flawed. He just got old and dependent.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say that you know, microscopic, you know, control, being a control freak is a flaw?
Today it is, yes.
Well, why wasn't it then?
Because there was no one else strong enough or bright enough to do that job. And so the benevolent dictatorship works well as long as the person in charge is cogent. But when that starts to fade, then you have severe problems. And that's, again, another lesson that we can learn from how all of this finally played out.
Okay, so if the mission of the society has now been amplified through other means, through media, through I don't want to call them surrogates, but through acolytes, through people who have learned, you know, like, for instance, I wouldn't be talking on this show about this material. I probably wouldn't be talking to you if that book hadn't fallen into my hands at the time it did. It was the right thing at the right time to set me on a course of curiosity. So that's the ripple effect of what he had created.
Absolutely.
Are there other people now who are doing similar things, or institutions doing similar things to what Hall was trying to create?
Not in the same way. You know, the internet has changed everything. For instance, you know, when I was teaching at the Philosophical Research Society, I would have, you know, a class of 50 people, 80 people, which was considerable. But now, I'm not limited to a physical location. I have students from all kinds of different states and all kinds of different countries. And we're not limited to, physical dense participation anymore. We're freed into the force so that like minds can find other like minds and not be dependent on physical limitations.
Hmm. Well, the internet certainly is allowing us to create. Was it Teilhard de Chardin who talked about the new sphere?
Yes.
Because we're in it. We're really in it. In fact, you might want to flesh out some of his ideas as it plays into what's going on now, because it's so Teilhard de Chardin.
Well, you know, whether you call it the Matrix or the Force or the etheric network, we are, in a sense, pioneering new territory that's not quite physical. You look at what's going on even in the gaming worlds on the internet, where people are creating a whole virtual realities where they can meet and talk and interact and have relationships and of all different frequencies. But we're freed from physical limitation, and this is huge. And the esoteric community is a little slow in moving into the new territory, but it is happening.
Well, when you say they're slow, I mean, there seems to be a million YouTubes on everything. I mean, you can just pick and choose, but there are no real teachers in that realm that people should actually pay attention to?
There's a lot of teachers, and that's the thing. Instead of a few...
Oh, you mean you have too many, and there's... It's back to the discernment. How do you select which channel? Which guru, which teacher is telling you? Really, I mean, it's basically a competition. It's like there's so many broadcasts now, so many radios, so many blogs, so many, you know, podcasts. It's really difficult to know who's giving you something that's worthwhile. Michael's calling. I think he has something he wants to ask you. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air. Michael? There you are. Are you with us? Hello, Michael. No, I'm not hearing him. Okay, you might try calling back. Sorry, Georgia. The technology tonight is really, really getting to us.
Let me answer what you just postulated.
Okay.
The best advice that I can give people is when people first are drawn to any kind of spiritual quest, they almost always have to go through some longer than others, a period of what I call spiritual smorgasbording. Because you have to know what's out there. No one system is going to be right for everybody. You have to go with what resonates with you, and what resonates with you at one level of the path may not be right for you at a later stage of the path. So whatever you're exposed to, you have to kind of bounce it off your own head and heart. And what rings true for you, move into that, study that, learn from that. But don't see it as God. Realize that that's going to give you a piece of the puzzle. And when you've absorbed that piece, there'll be a new piece. And so stay flexible. Learn to surf.
That's a great idea. Okay, Michael's back with us. Let's see if it connects. Michael? Hello? I'm hearing something, but I'm not hearing a person. Maybe it's Michael's dog. Maybe his dog. Well, he's got a great shot of his dog and him on the screen, and I think I can hear something, but it's not worthy of radio. So let's move on. Okay, so we have so many choices. I mean, it's like when people from other parts of the world come to the United States for the first time, and you take them into an average supermarket, and they're literally frozen.
Yeah.
Because they have too many choices. I think the esoterica smorgasbord approach gives people too many choices, and they get frozen in an indecision, and then they seem to latch on to the first voice or the first image or the first guru that hits them, as opposed to surveying the field and doing a measured process like you just described.
Well, sometimes that happens, but even the lesson of where not to look is a good lesson sometimes.
Ah, okay. Well, if Michael wants to try back another time, please try. I mean, I'm not sure why we're not making connection tonight. Okay, we only have a few minutes left. Let me ask you a very interesting question, at least to me as a writer. Why haven't you written a book about Manly Hall yet?
There have been other books written about him, and it's...
Yeah, but you're the person who was there, and you were there during a crucial phase, and you have a perspective in history of why it was important and how it's evolving. In other words, it seems to me that your book is what's missing.
Well, it's
hint,
not...
Hint. Not so subtly.
Well, I have a lot of work to do, and that's really not at the top of my list, quite frankly.
Okay.
Again, you know, there have been other books written about his life and death, actually. And you know, it's a good lesson to look at some of these great pioneers and to see the scope of their life. As I mentioned before, the two English workers that were stellar during World War II, Dion Fortune and Wellesley Tudor Pole, had very, very different ends, particularly Wellesley Tudor Pole, who had a marvelous life and was hale and healthy and vital and functioning up to the end. You know, they say that artists don't retire. Well, esotericists don't retire either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did Manly Hall actually have powers? Worked with him for 10 years.
He had mental powers. Did he have psychic powers? No.
Occult, kind of, whatever you would describe that term as. Did he actually, could he use the force to create things?
Oh, I'm sure. To some extent. I mean, the power of mental intent alone can move a lot of matter.
Yes. And being in L.A., I mean, let's go back to L.A. as the heart center. Is L.A. the heart center because that's where all these things get communicated from?
That's one aspect of it, absolutely. The original heart center was in Philadelphia.
Right.
You know, another conversation we might have in the future is a lot of people know about the Masonic involvement in the founding of this country. Very few people know about the Rosicrucian involvement, which was just as huge.
Mm.
And the early Rosicrucian communities were just outside of Philadelphia, and that is a whole fascinating story.
Which we will not get into tonight because we only have
nope.
a few minutes left.
Not tonight.
You know, that might be an interesting show because as we get into the summer, remember, this year the Democrats are holding their convention in Philadelphia. So that would be the perfect time to bring you on and talk about that. Michael, are you with us?
Yep.
Ah, there you are.
Here.
And
sorry
it's not his
that.
Talking dog.
A cute dog, by
okay.
the way.
Very cute, yes.
Quick question. I was wondering whether Manly P. Hall was ever involved in the occult. Did he know Crowley or Uri
you
Geller?
Mean, you, well, did you join us late? Because we talked a little bit about that at the top of the show, Georgia.
I don't know that he knew Crowley. I certainly knew of Crowley. And what kind of wacky world is it where Aleister Crowley and Julia Child are on the same side?
What?
Julia Child worked for the British intelligence, as probably did Crowley.
Okay, now you blow my mind twice tonight because Maria Hall and her whole fascination, And now you're telling me that Julia Child,
yeah,
whose cookbook I have in our kitchen,
yes,
was she a spy?
She worked for British intelligence before she became famous as a cook. That was actually alluded to in that movie about her, Julia and Julia. They actually did a sort of allusion to...
Oh, I didn't see that, no.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Was she into witchcraft then?
No. No, okay. not witchcraft. But, to answer you, he probably, I'm sure, knew of Crowley. And certainly, being here in Los Angeles in the 20s, he knew about the machinations of Jack Parsons
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, which is, yeah, for sending off Michael's question, did he know Parsons? Did he have any relationship to Agape and all of the stuff that was going on with Parsons and, you know, Scientology and JPL itself? And
I'm sure he knew of it. How much involvement, if any, he had. He really stayed away from that kind of stuff, but everybody knew everybody in those days, and I'm sure he knew about L. Ron Hubbard and Parsons and all their crazy stuff on Mount Palomar and all that stuff. Mm. I mean, he certainly knew all of that kind of thing that was going on.
Well, it certainly is intriguing. I mean, why is it, if you really look, Georgia, at the country, Los Angeles has become the focus of so many of these aspects of society that we don't normally talk about. Like there was, you know, remember Garner Ted Armstrong?
Oh, yeah.
He was based there in Pasadena.
Yep.
I remember hearing him when I was a kid on Sunday mornings. He would do these sermons and, you know, my dad would turn them on and, you know, we would basically, it was kind of like having four TVs these days. You'd have radios in a couple of rooms so you could go from room to room. And I remember two things, Garner Ted Armstrong for the interesting info, because pre-internet, and then the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Those are the two things that my dad would have on the radio on Sunday mornings. Very, very strange, because it, you know, one came from Salt Lake and the other came from Pasadena. In fact, I think I learned about Pasadena from Garner Ted Armstrong before years later I wound up working with JPL in Pasadena.
Well, you know, if you're going to spiritually smorgasbord, L.A. was the place to do it. It had everything from the highest, most sublime, beautiful teachings to just, I mean, I remember the first time I came to L.A. and I was driving in, it was night, and I saw this church spire with this huge purple pulsating neon heart on the top of it. And it had a prayer garden with a life-size statue of Jesus with plastic fruit on the boughs of the trees and piped in bird calls. And I knew, okay, I'm in L.A.
You're in L.A. Okay, we only got a couple of minutes left. What would you like to plug? We have your website up there. If people want to go back to Radio with Pictures, you'll scroll down to George's bio tonight. Lambert's Lodge. Tell us about Lambert's Lodge.
Oh, that's just my website where people can get in touch with me, learn a little bit about my classes, that kind of stuff. It needs to be updated badly, but I don't really have anything to plug. people can email me and get on my list for upcoming classes and some of the stuff that I do. The written works that I've produced have not been for the public. They've been for my classes. But I am working on something right now that will eventually be for the public. So,
okay.
But that's nowhere close to being finished.
Okay. We do have another caller. I think we have another caller.
You do, really quickly.
Go ahead.
It's me, Joy. Hi. I wanted to know how to spell Tudorpole because I'm trying to look for this guy on the internet. I can't find him anywhere.
His first name is Wellesley.
Uh-huh.
And his last name is Tudor, as in Tudor/POLE.
Okay. Also, did Manly Hall work with Paul Foster Case?
They certainly knew each other. And okay. of course, Foster Case had the builders of the Antietam
right
organization. That was another thing here in Los Angeles to add to the to the smorgasbord, right?
Yes, I have some old books that somebody just gave me that are just amazing. It's called The Tree of Life. It's just a series of books that I read many years ago.
Well, Hall had a lot of Kabbalistic connections, more so in his early years than after the war.
Well, it's fascinating. This is fascinating stuff. It's what led me on my path. So thank you for your show tonight. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
All right.
We'll all talk soon. The music's about to start. I'm at the end of the show. We're at the end of the show, everyone all around the planet that listens to us every morning. Georgia, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. You've provided a real window of enlightenment, if I can use that term, on a society and a guy that I've always kind of wondered about because there's so many things in his background.
And let's not let
And we don't have time, unfortunately. Okay. I want to tell you tomorrow morning, we will be same time, same bat channel here once again. Tomorrow morning's Open Hailing Frequencies. Remember, today is Super Tuesday. We're going to find out tonight and tomorrow morning who wins, where, how, and where it's going to take us. And we may have some other surprises. I want to thank Robin again. And by all means, listen to her show, Event Horizon, Revolution Radio, this morning at 8 o'clock, our time, here in the Land of Enchantment. And until we meet again, keep remembering, third star on the left, straight on till morning.